Hello and welcome to the AHN podcast. In today's episode, we journey to the 19th century Abeokuta, a city that is in the present day southwestern Nigeria. And today we're joined by Benjamina Efuadazi, a PhD candidate at the University of East Anglia. Her research explores Anglican missionary activities in Abeokuta between 1842 and 1867, tracing the journey of Egba artifacts collected by the Church Missionary Society. In our conversation today, she will be shedding light on how these objects move from sacred and political context in Abeokuta to missionary displays in Britain, and what this means for how we think about heritage today. Hi, Benjamina. You're welcome to the AHN podcast.
Hi, thank you so much, Sharon, for inviting me.
Great. So I would like us to start our conversation with a brief introduction of yourself, your background, and your journey within the cultural heritage space.
Yeah, sure. So I am currently speaking to you from the University of East Anglia, as you mentioned, where I am a PhD student. So my work can be broadly defined within the discipline of anthropology, but my background is in archaeology. And so I trained as an archaeologist. I have done field archaeology, but I think during that journey, I realized that my interest actually lies in what happens to the materials that we excavate, what happened to them after they are outside, after they have been unearthed. And so this kind of brought me into the museum. For my master's, I did an anthropology course, and that very much led me into what I am doing today. In fact, my research topic really actually emerges from the master's program that I did. I am Ghanaian, which sometimes surprises people because I study Nigerian culture. And so I just want to put that out there. But I do actually have some Nigerian connection. And interestingly, it didn't, like, these two things, my interest in Nigerian culture and my Nigerian sort of ancestry, I discovered these two things separately. And so it was quite nice that they ended up being very much together. A few years ago, I found out that my grandmother was actually, she's of blessed memory now, but she was the daughter of a Ghanaian woman and a Nigerian man. Well, at the time, Nigeria didn't exist, but my great-grandfather was from Abeokuta, which is so interesting, right?
Yes.
Exactly. And so I think... after realizing that, it almost made sense why I was drawn to Yoruba culture. And, you know, it just so happened that the collection that I focused on for my research topic, like, you know, come from Abeokuta. It was very much incidental. But yeah, that's a bit of my background. Yeah, I don't know if you have any...
No, that's an interesting background, because I was also gonna ask, Efua sounds Ghanaian.
Exactly.
So why, what's the, I'm not surprised though, that you have this connection. Most people in West Africa usually have that kind of connection. So I'm not surprised about it. But I wondered why Abeokuta. But that leads me to my next question. You have chosen this period, 1842 and 1867. Could you please, for the benefit of my listeners, set the scene for us? What was happening in Abeokuta? Why that period? Why did you choose that period, and
Yeah, sure.
what made it such a compelling site for missionary focus, really?
Yeah, sure. So, Abeokuta is a very interesting place. I mean, I think in the public consciousness, a lot of people know about Abeokuta because it's the hometown of people like Fela Kuti, and sort of the Ransome Kuti family. And you know, I think those that didn't know recently came to know because of the movie that was done on Chief Mulayo Ransome Kuti. And another interesting fact about Abeokuta is that it was actually one of the last surviving self-governing kingdoms of Yorubaland before sort of the advent of the British fully-fledged colonial settlement, and you know the Southern Protectorate and the rest of it. And so Abeokuta as a place, I find it very, very interesting. But going to the question you ask, yes, my research period, and you know, this is both a matter of because I'm doing a PhD, but you know, a PhD is a very limited amount of time during which you have to, you know, do something that they will tell you feasible and something that can actually complete. And you know, part of writing, because that's what it is, you have to produce a thesis. Part of writing is also creating a start and an end that makes sense to a reader or the examiner in my case. And so thinking about specifically the missionary history of Abeokuta, 1842, which is the sort of the starting point of the story, 1842 was the date, December 1842 was the date when the first missionary entered Abeokuta. And so this first missionary was called Thomas Birch Freeman, and he was a missionary of the Wesleyan Methodist Society, a British man, but he was actually mixed race. So he was not the first missionary to enter Abeokuta was not a white missionary. He was a missionary of African descent. And you can even catch that from his surname, Freeman. So a descendant of a free person. And so that was Thomas Birch Freeman. Following that, towards the tail end of that December, Henry Townsend, who was a missionary of the Church Mission Society, makes a journey also to Abeokuta, and he arrives in Abeokuta in January 1843. And Townsend was the first white man to enter Abeokuta, but he was not the first missionary to enter Abeokuta. And so, in the story I'm telling, in the narrative I'm trying to sort of craft in a sense, 42 is the beginning of the missionary entry. And then 1867, which is sort of the end of the period I focus on in the story, in October, on the 13th of October 1867, there was what was defined as an outbreak or a riot or a revolt in Abeokuta. This revolt, it was called Ifole, and please forgive my Yoruba. You are Yoruba, so you can tell me if I'm mispronouncing Yoruba words, but Ifole, so housebreaking, breaking the house. I can see that you are thinking.
I'm thinking, yes. I don't think I know. But go ahead.
So it was defined as Ifole, and this revolt or this outbreak riot, it was a moment in Abeokuta when all white people, including missionaries, were kicked out of Abeokuta, were chased away from Abeokuta. Churches were burnt, mission houses were robbed. It was just there was everything was scattered, and the missionaries were then sent away a few days after the outbreak. There was a meeting of the chiefs to understand what had happened, and eventually the decision was made that the other white people had to go, because this was within the context of the British government in Lagos. Because at this point, and sorry, I'm kind of throwing dates around, but I think it's important for people to have a bit of context. In 1861, Lagos Island, what we know as Lagos Island, became a British colony. So the King of Lagos ceded the Kingdom of Lagos to the British government, with all the rights to the territory. The king retained the title of king. In exchange, he got a pension, and his descendants could not have claim to the land anymore, but they could retain their royal sort of, I don't know, royal titles and the rest of it. So when Lagos becomes this colony, then there is a decision to be made as to the boundary of this territory. And actually the Abeokuta, or the Eba Kingdom, actually bordered the Kingdom of Lagos. And so there was a territorial dispute between the authorities of Abeokuta and Lagos, because the Eba people said that the Lagos government was trying to encroach on their land. And so there was a back and forth. There was a sort of a war, a conflict in Ikorodu, and I'm sure Lagos residents know Ikorodu. Ikorodu was a site in around 1864, a site of a conflict between Lagosians and the Eba people. Anyway, the short of it is that from the time Lagos became a colony, there was increasing tension between Lagos and Abeokuta. And this tension then kind of burst into this outbreak, where the authorities in Abeokuta, their claim, this is according to the sources, and I'm actually writing about this event. And so, if people are interested to know more about this, they would just have to wait and read about it. But I think from 61 all the way to 67, when the outbreak happens, it's kind of a buildup of tension and disputes. And the missionaries and merchants and traders, white missionaries and white traders that were living in Abeokuta, they were basically seen as part of this sort of British Empire and British government that resided in Lagos. And so the chiefs of Abeokuta were saying, since you guys came here promising us that, everything will be great and the land will be good, but we have all these conflicts and all these disputes with your own government. Because at this point, the white residents of Abeokuta, they are effectively British subjects. And also the black, the African residents, the missionaries, a lot of them are British subjects. And so I think this political tension really spills into the relationship between the missionaries and the authorities of Lagos. And so they were sent away. And so I stopped, to go back to our question, I stopped at 1867, because it seems to me that from that point there is a change in the dynamics between the missionaries and the people of Abeokuta, or the authorities of Abeokuta. The missionaries at this point no longer enjoy the protection of the chiefs of Abeokuta and even the sort of the care of the people of Abeokuta. And when the missionaries they leave Abeokuta, some go to Lagos, some go to other places. The church, the church infrastructure that has been created in Abeokuta, at this point, it has been over 20 years in the making. That infrastructure now is taken over by the African missionaries. And so there are people like William Moore, who then becomes sort of responsible for some of the activities of the Church Missionary Society in Abeokuta. So that's why I stopped in 1867, because I think a new order happens from there on.
I see. That honestly, like you said, something has to have the beginning and the end, but I see how this period is quite very interesting, and I'm looking forward to the findings. So let me go straight into your article now. So your article traces the provenance of the artifacts from Abeokuta to Britain, right? Could you kind of summarize the central narratives for the benefit of our listeners?
Yeah, sure. So, the article is actually a preliminary sort of finding. And in fact, since writing and even before publishing, there was new information that I came across. But again, everything has to have a beginning and an end. So, but yeah, the point of the article really is to share with people some of the ways in which material culture of the people of Abeokuta ends up in Britain. And I think, in the public consciousness, and I often talk about public consciousness, and when I say that, I refer to sort of the general knowledge that we all have about these cultural items and about object and about relations between African people and European people and sort of the historical narrative. So that's what I mean when I say public consciousness. In the public consciousness, we often think that objects historically belonging to African people, so in this case, Yoruba people, must have come to Europe, but necessarily by violent means and by means of oppression and dispossession. And I think what I was trying to share is that it's actually more nuanced than that. In this case, some people in Abeokuta, so some chiefs of Abeokuta, made decisions about parting with the material representations of their beliefs, of their customs, of their culture. And these missionaries decided to move these objects from Abeokuta to Britain. And so if I take, for example, one object, so there's a sword, well, it's a ceremonial sword, which Townsend, Henry Townsend, who, and I often talk about Townsend because he was actually the head of the mission. He was the secretary of the mission, from the sort of the first period of the mission. He was the secretary. And at this point, we are in and around 1848, 1851. That's like the period we are talking about. And so there's this ceremonial sword, and Townsend writes that this sword was given to him by the chief of Abaka, well, not by the chief of Abaka. It was obtained from the chief of Abaka, and it was given to him by a chief in Abeokuta. who got it following a war, and in quotes, a slave war with the chief of Abaka. And Abaka is a real place, it still exists today. And this sword, Townsend asks for it. So the chief, this chief of Abeokuta returns back to Abeokuta following the conflict with Abaka. He comes back, and back then, it was customary to, when you win a war, customary to sort of take everything you can take from that place, whether it's people to be enslaved, whether it is things to as physical representation of the victory, and trophies of war that dates back to the to sort of ancient times. So I think we kind of understand the purpose of loot of war. Anyway, so this chief comes back to Abeokuta, and in one way or the other, Townsend writes that he was given this ceremonial sword upon his request, upon Townsend's request. And in the article or in my research, what I try to do, I try to understand the conditions within which a chief such as, this chief of Abeokuta, who was victorious in this important war, why would he part with such an embodiment of his victory? Like, what relationship might exist between Townsend and this chief for this chief to part with this item? Okay. And part of what I'm trying to do is to really reflect on, the relationship that must have existed for this to be possible. So that's an example. And then, reasonable people might ask, okay, maybe the missionary coerced this chief to give him the sword or whatever. And I think, and this goes back to the public consciousness, part of what we have to understand about the past is that, and especially, the mid 19th century, in a place like Abeokuta, is that the missionaries were the minority. They were a very small part of the of that society. And at this stage, so I talk about Lagos being a colony in 1861. This sword gifting, or this sword giving, it happens in and around the 1848 thereabout. So you can understand that actually the missionaries, they were on their own. They didn't have an army, or they didn't have towers to be important people. That's just the truth. They were not, they were under the supervision and the protection of the chiefs of Abeokuta. And so, sometimes even the chiefs would decide that they didn't want their people to go to church, and they will seize people and they will put them in prison. And so the chiefs really had power to negotiate what they wanted, or they didn't want from the missionaries. And so I think in a setup like this, it is important to then think what situation is happening for someone like this victorious chief to part with this item. Yeah, and so that's what the article is really trying to do, is trying to give us some context as to some of the ways things end up in places like Exeter, in Southwest England. Yeah, and there are a few other stories, but I won't spoil it for people that want to read it.
I'd like us to unpack the methodology for your research. You combine archival records, missionary correspondence, and the objects themselves. Can you talk us through some of the examples as to how you utilized this methodology?
Yeah, sure. So, I have three, there are three sort of areas that I look at for this work. I look at the, before I say that, let me just say that the overarching, inquiry or what I'm trying to find out is the, what is the story of the missionary presence in Abeokuta. And I'm particularly focused on the I call it the nascent period of the missionary story. So the beginning, the first encounter, the first presence of Christian, British Christian Protestant missions in Abeokuta. What is the story of that period of birthing of that story? So to explore that, I'm really looking at three ways. And I'm doing that because I'm an anthropologist. I think a historian will probably use
Have a
other
different
sources or
approach.
less sources. Yes, we'll use a different approach. Historian will not use objects. An archaeologist will probably do something else. And so my work is trying to combine different sources to then try to tell a story that is from different angles and from different things. And when I say things, I mean material things. And trying to understand how people that were both there in Abeokuta and people that came to Abeokuta and people that are in Abeokuta, how they all experienced this history. And so, as you say, I use archival material, and the archival material is very much from the point of view of the missionaries because the archival material is written text that was produced by the missionaries. Protestant missions had a culture of writing letters to back to England. So wherever they were stationed, so in this case they were stationed in Abeokuta, they would write letters and journals, and they would send it through merchants or through whoever was sailing for England. They will send these letters, which will end up in the at the headquarters of the Church Missionary Society. In this case, other mission societies did the same thing, and this was not unique to Abeokuta or to Africa or to the, that mission. And so, because of this this way of working of that mission, they produced a lot of letters because every missionary that was employed by the Church Missionary Society was required in one way or the other to create these letters to tell them about their activities and so on. And so there's just a lot of written text about this period. I mean, it's like 25 years period. And imagine every year, every missionary produces loads of work. So I use that. And in my use of that, I try to understand, for example, different people can experience the same event, but actually talk about it in different ways or focus on different things. And so part of what I do is to try and understand the story from these points of view. And sometimes the choice of whose letter to read is really just based on what is available, because because we are working, that digital age had not arrived there yet. So, we have letters of we have the letters that survive, right? The letters that survive the journey from Abeokuta to the coast, from Abeokuta to Lagos. We have the letters that survive from Lagos to England. And so sometimes it's just what is there. Other times, when I'm lucky, there are several people that can talk to the same things. And certain missionaries write more or less about the experience. Some people prefer to just say, this is what happened, this is what I did, end of the story. Other people will tell you, this is what happened, this is how I felt, and this is how it impacted me, and this is how I'm going to behave next time. These are the people I converted, this is what they said. And so, there are people like Crowther, some Ajay Crowther, which a lot of Nigerians might have heard of. I find him as a very detailed writer and as a very he's very detailed oriented, and he talks a lot about the different experiences that there is a diversity in the experiences that he talks about. That's what I found compared to others that started with him during the same period. But also the other thing is, he was a Yoruba man, so also I think his relation with people and his also understanding of his experience is different from other people. And so when I'm analyzing these sources, I'm also thinking about who is this person? What is their experience? Where did they come from? Do they speak the language, or do they have to learn the language? What is their proficiency in the language? And so how are they able to communicate? And so, I mean, I don't know how they're able to communicate, but I can infer from sometimes from what they write, the extent to which they have understood, the situation they're in. And obviously this only happens when you're comparing it with, someone like Crowther or other people like Andrew Wilhelm or William Marsh. We're all missionaries. Okay, so that's one. Two, I look at the objects. And so I've already mentioned the ceremonial sword earlier. And so, for example, this sword, which changes hands from one person to the other, I'm looking at it and analyzing it as evidence of the occasion, right? The occasion being this exchange between a chief and a missionary, or a gifting between a chief and a missionary, or even as evidence of a war. And so the object becomes an evidence of the occasion, and so it helps me to actually then understand what I explained before. How does this guy end up having this thing that apparently looks very important? Okay, and so I do that for different objects, and for that I must say that I came across a collection of objects from Abel Kuta, from Henry Townsend. So this missionary Henry Townsend, when he retired and went back to Exeter, his hometown, he had gathered loads of objects through different means, and he donates to his city museum a portion of all these objects that he had collected. He donated about 40 objects to the museum. And this was sort of between 1868 and 1869, thereabout, the 60s anyway. Then once these objects enter in the museum system, obviously new stories are told about these objects, and they kind of embody different things. And I'm actually currently writing about this idea of entering in the museum and becoming a museum thing. And so the objects, they have this function. And then the third item I'm looking at to explore the story is the stories of people, the what we might call oral history, so sort of all traditional history. Some people say traditional history. And actually, I think, and I'm going to unravel what I said before about the start and the end. So yes, I end in 1867, but not really, because I come to the contemporary, grateful to the present to understand the legacy of this history. And so there's actually the final chapter of my thesis talks about the legacy of the missionary of the missionary history of that missionary history. And I explore this legacy through sort of the different people that have a claim to this history. And so what I do actually with that is I did field work. I lived in Abeokuta for a couple of months. What I was doing there was interviews and also experiencing Abeokuta as this place that is the legacy of all these different histories. And so I went to places like Olumo Rock, and I went to places like the Aké Church, to the King's Palace, all these places. And part of that work was really also to see what has stayed in the landscape about this history. And so you can think of names of places and names of schools and also who is honored in different areas. So, you know, when you go to Olumo Rock, there is the narrative that is, for example, presented to sort of the tourists. Whose story is that? And when I say whose story is that, I mean, who are the protagonists of that story, right? And what choices were made or not made to present those protagonists. And so, yes, I'm still sort of in the historical past, but looking at how it manifests today. Because, you know, in the end, we are experiencing this history from the today, right? And so I think for me, it was important to go to Abeokuta and sort of talk with the people who are the custodians of this history. And also the reality is not everything is in books. And you know, I had a great interaction with some of the chiefs in Abeokuta, and some of the chiefs, they were telling me stories that then helped me make sense of what I had read. But at the same time, it's also interesting to kind of see where some of the stories that are told today, where they come from, having looked at the archive and having looked at the objects. And so, yeah, so my methodology, it's multidisciplinary. It's broad, and it's broad on purpose because I mean, what I do, I don't do archaeology. What I do is to try to understand how people lived and how they engaged with the environment around them and the people around them. And people expressed who they were and how they experienced the landscape around them through things. So they made things. And they gave things, and they talked about things. And so part of what I do is really to understand all these different ways of being.
Interesting. Just before we move ahead, I'd like us to, I mean, you've mentioned a few things about the methodology, but I'd like you to narrow it down, the challenges and the advantage of this methodology that you've used.
I think the challenge with, you know, with the archive, I mean, I think I've mentioned it before. The challenge is you have the story that is there. You know, you can't, and you know, my work is qualitative, so yeah, I can make analysis, and I can sort of make informed interpretations of what I am observing. But the reality is you have the story that is there. And so, for example, there's this missionary, Andrew Wilhelm. Andrew Wilhelm, he was a catechist, what they called a catechist. And he, in his letters, he wrote that by a certain point, so by like the late 1840s, he had written to the Church Missionary Society seven letters. But in the archive, there are only four letters. And so then the question becomes, where's the rest? Okay. Where's the rest? Who knows what information would have been in there? And so, that's the challenge. But I also think part of it is location of material, so the archives, the Church Mission Society archives are at the University of Birmingham. And I'm fortunate that being in England, I'm able to visit regularly and look at the material. And some of the material is also available digitally through a subscription service. But for example, there are Church Mission Society material at the University of Ibadan, at the university, well, the National Archive at the university. And I only visited once, and I haven't been able to access that material. And so, for example, I have a sense of what is there. I saw the catalog. I have a sense of what is there. But there isn't enough time in a PhD to do the kind of systematic work that,
It's
I
required.
would love to do. Okay. And so necessarily some of the stories will not make it to the narrative and things will be overlooked and that will shape the story. I think with field work, the challenge I had is, the time was limited. I was only there for two and a bit months, as it happens, things start becoming really sort of deep towards the end because now relationships have been formed. I have a better knowledge of the environment. And so I'm able to sort of be more intentional. And so, again, I go back to limited time, limited resources. So yeah, those have been the challenges. But overall, I think part of having these different sort of sources to explore has helped in kind of directing attention to different narratives. I mean, my intention is not to write the history of early missions in Abeokuta. That's not my intention, because between the 40s and the 60s, the period I cover, there were at least three missions in Abeokuta. There was the Methodist mission, there was obviously the Anglican mission, which is what I focus on, and there was also the Baptist mission, the Southern Baptist Convention from the US. In later years, about 20 years later, sort of 15, 20 years later, the Catholic missions also come to Abeokuta. And so, if I were to research the history of early missions in Abeokuta, I wouldn't be able to graduate from this PhD. So I think part of the work is also accepting that this is limited and this is you're just scratching the surface of what is there.
I was going to ask you about the concept of handover rather than gifts, because your article really challenges, the way the missionaries framed that narrative around, oh, it was freely given. You argued for a more nuanced interpretation that considered the the political obligation, the exchange, and then the colonial power dynamics and all of that. I would like you to kind of maybe using just one example or case study, try and expand on that a bit.
Okay, so a gift is me offering you something. Okay, so I give you money, I give you clothing, I give you whatever. A gift is just that, giving something. A gift can be political, but a gift can also be personal. And so, for example, historically, the relationship between African people and European people was actually formed on the basis of trade. And part of, we are talking about like the 1400s, like we are talking about sort of the modern period. The part of what merchants would do when they would come to the shores of the African continent is to bring with them gifts for the chiefs or the middlemen. That will help them then trade with the peoples that were in the mainland, and so yeah, gifting it's a concept that has a long history in the relationship between Africans and Europeans. So that's we all understand that. Handover, on the other side, it's sort of a concept that I come to based on my reading of the relationship. So I decide I want to convert for whatever reason. I decide I want to convert from indigenous African religion or African traditional religion as it is known today. I want to convert from that to Christianity. Part of that conversion, it's also, taking classes, doing Sunday school, all those things. Missionaries required people to do those things. And part of the teachings that you are given is you shall not worship other gods, and you will not hold idols, and all those kind of things. And so part of, and this is in the Bible, by the way, part of the religious transformation journey of some people in Abeokuta was effectively once they become Christian, they give up or they rid themselves of the material representations of their what is now their former religion. Okay. And so when I talk about handover, I'm talking about handing over to the missionaries or to the mission, the what effectively are the representations of the religion that no longer serve them. And in the article, I think about the idea of sacrifice in the sort of the Christian worldview. But also I think, and this is something that didn't make it to the article, but I think also sacrifice could also be seen as part of the indigenous religion that a person is coming from. The idea of sort of giving up something to get something. And it's not going to find space in my research just because I don't have the time for to write about it. But I think someone should definitely write about the idea of sort of transposing, I don't know, transposing these indigenous understanding of divinity into the sort of the Christian transformation or the Christian conversion process. What I mean by that is how did indigenous people understood the idea of Christian divinity compared to their own idea of divinity? And so I think when we think about these things, we are better sort of primed to understand what it might have meant for an Egba person to understand that they might have wanted to hand over. So yeah.
Interesting. Interesting. So I'd like us to talk about the contemporary relevance of all of this. Oh, yeah. So in your view, how did the missionaries display an interpretation of these objects in Britain shape their perspective of Abeokuta and Yoruba religion?
That's very interesting, and I think you might like to read my thesis when it's done. So,
We look forward to that.
no, this is a really good question because actually, the chapter I'm currently writing, really, I'm trying to think about these things. How do narratives of Abeokuta formed through these things? And I think what I can say is to really set the scene in the sense that imagine to the extent that you can, imagine England or Britain in the 1840s or 1850s or 1860s. The Industrial Revolution is picking pace. There are all these missionaries and merchants and travelers going to different places, and they're writing and bringing all these ideas about the world and creating all these images of the world that exists outside. Most British people, they cannot even fathom what is outside. It's not like today that you see things everywhere. And so the way most people in this country knew about places like Abeokuta was through the people, the missionaries and the merchants and the traders that were there. And these merchants and missionaries and traders, they wrote about the things they cared about. Okay. And so if we think about how Abeokuta was known to British people in this period, it was very much through the writings of the missionaries and the extracts that were published. And so a lot of the missionary societies had magazines and periodicals that they published, and people could buy them, subscribe to them. If you were part of a church community, like a parish, for example, you went to Sunday school and the like gatherings, these were the spaces where you would hear these stories about all these activities. And so during these moments, both in writing and also in sort of person when they will have meetings, the missionaries who are, the people that are of interest to me, they will actually bring some of the things they are collected, or they will bring them, and they will showcase it to people, and they will tell the stories that are the stories that accompany these objects. And obviously the stories are from their point of view. And so there were people in Britain who had never been to Abeokuta but actually had what would appear a very firm grasp of what Abeokuta was, what is there, who are the people of Abeokuta, because of this continuous flow of information.
All right, so I'm going to ask the other side of it. How is this history remembered in Abeokuta today, particularly within communities that were connected to these chiefs or where these missionaries actually did have impact?
I think the story of mission, or at least the story of early mission in Abeokuta today, is really remembered through the personal family histories of prominent people of Abeokuta. Or when I say prominent, really is historically prominent people of Abeokuta. And so, for example, if you go to Abeokuta today and you ask about, where did the missionaries go when they came here? You might hear the name of the Shodeke family, or you might hear the name of the Ogunbono family, or Ogundipe, or the Shomoye family. And so, and people will tell you, for example, to go to Olumorok. And when you go to Olumorok, Olumorok will then sometimes send you to these families to engage with them to understand the history of mission according to their family experience. And so I would say that from a sort of from a narrative point of view, that's the story. When it comes to sort of the actual sort of presence of the legacy or the presence of the visible presence rather of the mission, then you have the people will send you to the church, to the Akè Anglican Church. People will send you there, or to other churches like in the main the church there. Because yes, obviously, while being a church history, the physical presence of the church also sort of is an immediate connection to that. Yes, I think the history of mission today in Abeokuta really very much rests with personal stories. And when I say personal story, I don't mean sort of personal stories like someone will tell you stuff, but as in stories of families and their own engagement with the mission. And these stories, my sense was that it's not like you are told there's a plaque somewhere, when you go to the historical part of Abeokuta. So there's this area in Abeokuta, which is to so the Ikija area and the Ake area, sort of that's like the historical part of Abeokuta, together with others. But kind of thinking about the first site of mission, the Ake area. When you go there, it's not like there's a plaque that tells you, here lies the house of the chief who welcomed the missionaries or whatever. You have to ask. And I find that to be very much part of experiencing an ancient, well, what I call an ancient site as Abeokuta. You have to engage with people to actually hear about the story of the people.
Stories.
Yeah.
Interesting. So I want to ask you, how do you navigate presenting this history in a way that respects both the archival records, and the local oral histories?
That's a tough question. How do I present this history in a way that respects the archival record and also the experience of people today? I think part of what I try to do is just tell the story of what is there, but also what is not there. Or what is trying to be there, so what we may have a sense of but don't have a reality for. And so, for example, when it comes to, for example, current narratives, when I went to Olumorok, there's a section of Olumorok, and people who have been there would understand this. There's a section where there are sort of really bas relief of the chiefs or the prominent people of Abeokuta. And so there are There's a portrait of Shodeke, there's a portrait of I think Lishabi, and there's a portrait of Madame Tinubu. And these are important people in the history of Abeokuta, as presented as important people in the history of Abeokuta. But for example, Lishabi never made it to Abeokuta. So Lishabi, when the Egba people entered Abeokuta, they did not come with Lishabi. And so in a case like this, you are presented with this history. So then my job is really to try to understand what are the people trying to do here. So yeah, that's part of it. And for the archive, I mentioned it earlier about how, someone will say, "Oh, I sent seven letters," but there are only four that I find in the archive. And so part of my job is then to think about what might have been there that is not there, or the story that is being told, is it complete? So I'm not trying to tell what is not there. I'm just trying to say this is not there. And so this is why we have this selection of story.
I would like to ask, more generally now, what the role of provenance research is in the ongoing debate around restitution and heritage ownership.
I think provenance research is very important. It's important both for the case for restitution, but also it's important for us as people to, as part of enriching ourselves and understanding our own history and where we are coming from and where our material is coming from. And part of that is also actually understanding the relationships between us as people. And so, for example, there are material in what I call the Abeokuta collection. So this is the collection that Henry Townsend donated to the museum in Exeter. The material there, it's not all from Abeokuta. What is interesting is that it was all found, or it was all how do you call it? Gathered or collected in Abeokuta, but it was not all from Abeokuta. There are items that came from Dahomey, and there are items that also came from other parts of Yoruba land, and also from beyond Yoruba land in the north. And so the way we understand this is by doing the research, by understanding what events took part, sorry, what events took place at this time in this place to enable this material, this object to be there at that time. And when it comes to, so I think that it's part of us understanding who we are and where our material things come from. But also for the case for restitution, for people and communities that want their cultural belongings back to them, provenance research is important because it actually sort of actively engages the source of the material. How are we going to know, and in a sense, how are we going to let the institution or the body that is carrying or is holding our belongings, how are they going to understand that they are holding material from loot or material from violent dispossession or dispossession? It doesn't even have to be violent. How are we going to make a case for that if we don't know where the material is coming from. So, you know, I don't say this just as a researcher. Obviously, you know, thank you. Give me a job to do this. So I guess I'm biased here. Research is important. But from just a pragmatic point of view, it is important for us to know where things are coming from and the history of the material we are looking at to actually strengthen our case for restitution wherever it is.
What are your next steps for this research following this publication?
Well, hopefully finishing my PhD. So the publication was just actually just an article that came out of a chapter of my thesis. I thought it was important for people that are interested in my work to just have something to refer to, something to also help them have a context of what I'm doing, because, you know, it's easy to talk about it, but when people want to actually sit with the material and think about things, they need something. And so, yeah, so that was just that. But yeah, I have a thesis that I am trying to complete as we speak now. Hopefully that will be done by early next year. So yeah, so my next step is really finish the thesis, hopefully graduate, defend my thesis and graduate. And I am hoping to return back to the museum sector to work in collections management, but also I will continue to research the biography of things and the origin of material. I think Abeokuta and sort of Yorubaland is where, you know, my training lies, but it's by no means the only area I am interested in. And also it's not the only area I would like to research. I think missionary work is something I'm really passionate about in terms of understanding. And so I have done sort of very small research on missions in places like Fiji, but also in a perception of divinity in places like Brazil. So, you know, I'm hoping to continue researching, but from the space of a museum, as a museum worker.
Thank you so much, Benjamina, for your time. Thank you for sharing your research.
Thank you for having me.
So that was my conversation with Benjamina. If you'd like to read more, I encourage you to look at a recently published article, Collecting Abeokuta. And of course, stay tuned for our next episode, where we'll be joined by both Benjamina and Peter Jegede to hear about their collaboration and shared field work. Until then, thank you for listening.